When I was just 10 years old, I had my first crush. He was a boy in my class, and so naturally, I told my best friend at the time about it. She was sworn to secrecy. One day, this brilliant creative idea came to my mind. I was going to write him a letter. A letter to declare my feelings towards him. So there's 10-year-old me at home, pouring her heart out in a letter. I'm pretty sure I even drew a picture of us getting married or something. It was a big deal to me. The next day at school, when no one was looking, I dropped this letter into the boy's bag. And then what happened next was absolutely nothing. He never spoke to me about it. We never established or acknowledged that letter, which in hindsight was a very good thing for me. But that was my first of many experiences where I felt disappointed, hurt, confused, and more than anything, embarrassed. Now, I feel like I need to give some context as to why I wrote that letter in the first place. It comes back to the greatest love story that I know, and that is the love story between my parents. My parents met in university back in China. I grew up hearing this story of how they met, and based on the way they've described it, I like to imagine it was kind of like when Troy and Gabriella met in High School Musical. You know the scene where they're singing on stage together, it's all sappy and wholesome. Except it was only my mum who was singing on stage. Dad was actually watching from the crowd. And he was love struck. Essentially, after that karaoke night, my dad, guess what he did? He wrote my mum a letter. She tells me that when she read this letter, it was her turn to be love struck. She could see in Dad's writing sincerity and eloquence, and this is how their love story began. My mum and Dad were the first and only lovers for each other. They were each other's first date, first shared bike ride, because that was a thing in their time, first kiss. They shared all their firsts together. And next year, they celebrate their 40th anniversary. Now that's as perfect of a love story that you can get, right? So you can maybe start to understand why 10-year-old me had the idea of writing a letter to her crush. My parents got a happy love story, and their journey all started with a letter. So in my mind, I was just following the only model of romantic love that I knew at the time. I held their love story in my mind as a picture of what I thought my own love story might look like. Yes, even at 10 years old. Well, I would learn in the years to come that love doesn't just happen like that for most people. In fact, as I grew older, I learned about the hardships and trials that even my parents had gone through. Love is complex. It's not all that straightforward. One of the reasons love is complex for us today is that you and I sit in this cultural tension, this tug of war between two opposing cultures. Kane put it this way in the very first week of this series. There's one culture which says, go, chase every desire. Then there's another culture which says, suppress desire. The first one, chase every desire, which I would say is the dominant culture in our Western world. The motif of this is basically, do what makes you happy. Other selling lines from this narrative is, try before you buy. You know, as long as you're not hurting anyone, as long as you're happy, anything goes. What happens is the body becomes this commodity, a vehicle fueled by pleasure and a product to convince others you're worth buying. We see bodies being used in marketing in such a sexually provocative way on posters and ads, whether it's for lingerie or even something like perfume. Whenever I'm in the mall with my 3-year-old, I'm extra aware of just how commodified the human body has become. So on one hand, we've got the culture around us that says, chase every desire. On the other hand, we've got the culture that says, suppress every desire. This is a culture that emerged from within the church, initially as a response to the first culture. You may have heard the term purity culture. This was coined to describe a movement in the 90s, which was aimed at pursuing purity by fleeing sexual immorality, but done in a way that conflated sexual conduct with morality. Meaning essentially, you're either a good or bad person based on your sexual history. That's what purity culture said. The fruit of this has been lasting negative repercussions that many of us are familiar with even today. It promoted this fear of doing the wrong thing before marriage, and there was also this intense shame that came if you did step out of bounds, or even think that you stepped out of bounds. The stories that come out of purity culture is that people felt like sex, and even sexual desire, was dirty, and something to be embarrassed about. On a deeper level, people would feel like something was wrong with them if they even had an inkling of a sexual thought. The reality of living in the midst of these two cultures is that we can feel like we need to choose between the two. Like if I want to be a good Christian, then I have to suppress my desires. Or if I'm experiencing the longing to chase my desires, then maybe I'm not a good Christian. I want to make it clear that God's heart for love and his view on our sexual design is neither of these. In this series, we're following an erotic love poem. And this week, we've gotten to the part where the beloved, in the song's words, comes into the woman's garden. If you missed it, this is a metaphor for describing that the two lovers are having sex. In case you're only just joining us in the series or have forgotten, the man in this relationship, he's not Solomon. Solomon can instead be seen as a literary figure to contrast with the beloved, who is the man in this poem. So Solomon and the beloved are two opposing representations of love, with the beloved representing the ideal love. Now, what do we mean by ideal love? The ideal love that we've seen and heard about through the song is that it's exclusive, mutual, and intimate. And we see this intimacy in the metaphor of the garden as her body. I love the beauty in garden imagery, as it's also a subtle nod to the Garden of Eden. Like in Eden before the fall, we see the two lovers sharing an intimacy with each other in a way that is naked and unashamed. How do we know there was no shame? Well, just like in Genesis 2, when it was described that Adam and Eve felt no shame, right after the lovers share in sexual intimacy, we hear their community chiming in. Eat, friends, and drink. Drink your fill of love. That's in chapter 5, verse 1. Their love is celebrated by community. How does the beloved describe the woman's garden, her body? In chapter 4, verses 13 to 14, we get the picture of a lush and fragrant garden filled with a variety of fruit and spices. This comes after he's listed out the physical attributes of the woman, and I know most of the similes he used sound kind of weird, but the image that he's painting of his lover is actually tender, thoughtful, rich with adoration. Their attraction to each other isn't just physical either. So intimate is their love that the lovers talk about the senses of smell and taste in describing their intimacy. There are descriptions of her fragrance, the sweetness of her lips. Both are sensory descriptions that imply closeness and a deeper knowing of one another. Now this is a love that is intimate. One of the other ways the man describes her garden is locked up. In chapter 4, verse 12, he elaborates that she's like a spring enclosed, a sealed fountain. We get the sense that the woman doesn't just let anyone enter her garden, that her body is a sacred place exclusive to her lover. So just as the beloved has only one woman in mind, from the woman's perspective, access to her is also exclusive. In both of their eyes, they are the only ones for each other. In chapter 5, verse 9, the woman responds to this question from the community around them. They're asking her, "What makes your men so special?" We see that the ideal love has defined borders around it, because in order to have this exclusive kind of love, she needed to be able to make a distinction between him and other men. He has a unique, special place for her as she has for him. And this is a huge contrast to Solomon, who had 700 wives, 300 concubines. This moment of intimacy between the lovers, it's intimate and exclusive. It's a reminder to us that love requires both closeness and boundaries. So bringing it back to the two cultures I mentioned at the start, the one that says chase every desire and then the other that says suppress your desires, where does this poem place us? In some ways, the lover's romance actually validates both of these views, but it also points out the flaws in them as well. The lover's sexual intimacy is filled with passionate desire. Their attraction towards one another is clear. But at the same time, there's this restraint shown in the fact that this romance is exclusive. She chose for her garden to belong exclusively to him. So there's freedom in experiencing passion, sexual desire, but restraint in being selective about where that desire is directed towards. Unlike what purity culture advocated, our value isn't defined by the rules we keep or don't keep. And unlike what the world around us would say, the right kind of restriction having boundaries is good for us when it points us to the ideal love. So the ideal love is intimate while being exclusive, and it's also mutual. As part of this garden imagery, we also see that the woman not only reciprocates her beloved's love, but much like in the opening of the song back in chapter 1, she's pretty forward about her desires towards him. In fact, she seems to be the one who opens the door to let him in. Notice the language she uses. In chapter 4, verse 16, "Let my beloved come into his garden." The woman is given agency and choice to invite the man in. Now let's just take a moment to process how countercultural that would have been. Even today, women aren't typically seen as the initiators of relationships. Far from the imagery of conquest and even coercion, which we've seen the song depict the character of Solomon in, the way in which our two lovers come together in sexual intimacy was built on consent and an explicit invitation from the woman. She's so ready to let her lover in that she even calls her garden his garden. Let my beloved come into his garden. I actually had a read of some of my dad's letters to my mom, and in one of them he wrote a sweet line that said, "What's mine is yours. What's mine is yours." Now when I hear the woman in the song calling her garden, her body, as his own garden, I think of a similar sentiment expressing union and belonging between the lovers. This sense of belonging to one another is echoed in chapter 6, verse 3, when the woman declares, "I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine." This mutuality of love, this oneness, embodies to me the type of union which the Bible uses to describe marriage. I think again of Adam and Eve and how it was said that two becomes one flesh. Now that's the core of both marriage and sexual intimacy. Essentially, it's two becoming one. It was at this point of the poem where I had the question, wait, they are married, right? The natural assumption as we read the account of the lover's sexual intimacy is that they are married. I mean, the beloved uses the word bride. But an interesting thing to know here is that bride doesn't necessarily mean she's his wife, or even that they're engaged. It's actually a term of endearment to show affection, same as the word sister in the poem. While today we might call someone we love babe, in their time, an equivalent would be bride or sister. Now, when I learned this, I started digging deeper on this question of whether they're married. While I was surprised yet again to learn another clue that the lovers might not be married. Later in chapter 8, verse 1, we'll learn that the lovers don't feel free to kiss in public, which would be a strange thing for a married couple to say. So we actually can't be sure that the lovers are married or even engaged. This presents us with a dilemma, doesn't it? How could the lovers possibly not be married? Yet the imagery of him entering her garden is pretty clearly one of sexual union. I personally found this not only puzzling, but problematic. In fact, I felt so confused that I called up Kane because this felt like territory more for our young adults minister to answer. What Kane helpfully reminded me of was, firstly, that whenever we read scripture, whether it's in the Old Testament or New Testament, we never take a single verse or passage and then form our entire belief system around it. So what this song is not saying is to give a green light for sex before marriage, because that would be inconsistent with other passages of scripture. Remember that the purpose of the song is to contrast between two types of love, ultimately pointing us to the ideal love. Mutual, exclusive, intimate. And that's everything we see here in the lover's sexual intimacy. This poem is like a lighthouse pointing us to the love we should look for while shining a light on the love we shouldn't settle for. The song holds up to us this juxtaposition. Solomon, though married to 700 wives, like that's a lot of marriages, he is the opposite of the ideal love. In fact, his so-called love for women is so far from the ideal love, this poem tells us, that even an unmarried couple who engages in mutual, exclusive, and intimate love has a better grasp on what true love really is. What I'm hearing from the writer of the song, if we're to read between the lines, is let's not get caught up about the legality of the couple's sexual activity, because within the message of this song, the intent of this song, marital status isn't what defines the ideal love. What's truly shocking about this song is that we see how love upholds the dignity of the body, even when the surrounding culture, think of King Solomon's love, disregards this dignity. True love upholds the dignity of the body, even when the surrounding culture disregards this dignity. So could it be that God actually cares for a person's dignity more than their cultural purity? Or better yet, what if upholding, maintaining, and restoring the dignity of the body is in itself purifying? What if that's what purity actually is? To love someone the way that God has intended each of us to be loved. I think of examples in the New Testament of Jesus' compassion for someone's dignity, like for the woman caught in adultery, told in John 8. He doesn't disregard the rules, but he also doesn't cast shame. While others were casting stones, using her past as a definitive judgment of her value, Jesus doesn't condemn her. He stays with her as others leave in an act of restoring value and dignity. Jesus shows us that it is possible to see the person who's broken the rules and stay with them instead of jumping to a moral judgment. There's a similar thread here in what could be seen as scandalous in the song, which shows God just might care about the person more than their perceived or even legitimate breaking of the rules. I mean, that's the whole point of the gospel. It's why Jesus came on this earth. His mission was to make a way for us to no longer have our worth defined by our actions. He wants us to live free from shame and condemnation. Now, I don't want to finish this sermon without acknowledging that everyone here has a unique past. Some of us, when we heard that analogy of the garden being locked up, might have been thinking, but that's not me. My garden has not only been unlocked, it's also been stepped all over and looking pretty rough. Maybe your experience of intimacy hasn't been mutual or exclusive. To this group of people, I want to say, this is not the way love was meant to be, and Jesus' heart for restoration is for your story too. When we hope in an eternity with him, we also put our hope in a new earth and new body. And I believe that even now, before he comes back, he is restoring bodies, minds, and stories to wholeness. One of the ways that God restores individuals is through his body, the community of believers. As we've seen in purity culture, the church hasn't always succeeded in promoting this restoration. And so it would be fair if you ever felt like when you're with church friends that there's this pressure to suppress every desire. Maybe feeling like this is a you problem that you have to try and sort out on your own. And maybe you see your friends chasing those desires and you feel the longing to be free with no restriction. And that's a hard place to be in. What would it look like for us to be a community who care more about a person's dignity in love than in their perceived cultural purity? I wonder what it would look like for each of us to have specific people we can go to about this stuff, where we can be vulnerable, ask those awkward questions, seek out wisdom, admit when we mess up, and search for accountability, but also to be real. The Daughters of Jerusalem, they're the women's community, and they were pretty direct. They asked, "What makes him so good?" They also affirmed and celebrated the lovers. Both their questions and celebration showed that they must have been on the journey with the lovers in the first place. This song is a brilliant picture for us that pursuing intimacy and the ideal love actually works best in community. And that community, it can't just be Sundays at church. The vulnerability that's needed to bring people on your journey requires trust and safety, and that takes intentional quality time to build. I mentioned in the beginning that this letter I wrote when I was 10 wasn't the first time I felt embarrassed in this journey on love. Between that first letter and then eventually meeting and marrying Dan, there were lots of challenging moments for me. Times where I truly thought to myself, maybe I'm just never going to get that happy ending like my parents did. But along the way, I got to meet a group of friends who became my Daughters of Jerusalem. These are the friends who listened to my past, knew my hurts as well as the things I was still struggling with, and met me with Jesus' compassion. I also found mentors who were able to speak into the questions I had. One of my mentors also knew Dan before we even started dating. She was someone I confided in before Dan knew I had feelings for him. She later became an active part in us coming together as a couple. Having both friends and mentors around me who got to know my specific story and then encouraged me along the way meant that I didn't have to wrestle through questions alone. So, who are your people? Who are the friends who can remind you of truth when you're feeling far? Who do you feel safe with or think that you can build that safety with? Who around you is maybe a life stage or two ahead of you, someone you can draw wisdom from? I want you to ask God these two questions. Who are my people? Ask God for specific names. And then what's one step I can take towards them this week?